I've never made any secret of the fact that my favorite outdoor writer is the late Patrick McManus. In fact, he's one of my favorite authors of any genre. If you haven't read Pat, or haven't heard of him, or don't know anything about him, he was a regular columnist first for Field & Stream and then Outdoor Life during a writing career that spanned decades. He was also a professor of English at Eastern Washington University. When I was still a classroom teacher, I told kids that he was who I wanted to be when I grew up. His specialty, at which he maybe had no equal, was short outdoor humor. I have used snippets and excerpts from his work through the years and once read an entire story, though that's been something like a decade ago or more. Today, as a change of pace, let's go with some McManus, with a story specifically dealing with an outdoor issue that would seem to me to be pretty relevant at the moment. Because he was a lower 48 guy, this particular story deals with elk and deer. Feel free, in your mind, to substitute in moose and caribou as you listen to it. The message of the story is still a very funny one. Welcome to Bristol Bay Field Notes. I'm Terry Fuller, Education Specialist for Togiak National Wildlife Refuge. Let's get right to it. This particular story is called Share and Share Alike, from the first McManus book I bought back when I was 14, called Never Sniff a Gift Fish. The sharing of a single big game animal between two hunters is at once the most delicate and the most complex problem encountered in hunting, with the possible exception of deciding whose vehicle to drive on the hunt. It may be useful to examine the problem in some detail. Let us begin with a hypothetical situation. As is well known, an elk that is shot dead within 15 feet of your hunting vehicle will still pull himself together enough to gallop to the very bottom of the steepest canyon within 5 miles. This is known as elk's revenge. Assume you have just shot such an elk. You and your hunting partner, whom we'll call Bob, have tracked the elk to the bottom of the canyon. As you stand over the massive form of the felled but still magnificent animal, you become contemplative. One of the things you contemplate is how much bigger an elk is at the bottom of a canyon than it is 15 feet from your vehicle. You now ask yourself two questions. How are you going to lug the elk back to your vehicle, and why didn't you go golfing today instead of hunting? With 3 round trips each, you and Bob managed to pack out the elk section by section. Neither of you experiences any extraordinary ill effects from the exertion, other than the seizing up of major portions of your cardiovascular systems. Bob lies wheezing by the side of the road, a haunch of elk still strapped to his back. You are walking around on your knees and mumbling about getting in shape and not caring if you never see another bleeping elk. At this point, you are willing to give the entire elk to Bob, provided that he lives. Your intimate association with elk meat over the preceding hours has diminished your appetite for the stuff and has resulted in a psychological malfunction known as excessive generosity. Wisely, you put off the decision of what share of the elk should go to Bob until you are rested and your mind has cleared. The culinary aspects of elk meat improve in direct proportion to distance and time from the packing out process. A week after the hunt, during which time the elk has been aging nicely in a cooler, the thought of all those steaks and roast stashed away for the winter is intensely satisfying. There is still the problem of what portion of the elk should be Bob's share. You are now in the proper frame of mind to make that decision. Your reasoning goes something like this. For openers, you consider giving Bob half the elk. Once you have enjoyed a few moments of mirth over this ridiculous notion, you get down to serious figuring. Using half an elk as a base, you deduct from it 5 pounds for each day remaining in the season, days in which Bob might very well shoot his own elk. You make further deductions for the amount of whining Bob did while packing out your elk. Then there is the matter of that unseemly phrase Bob blurted out when he learned the elk you had shot was at the bottom of a 3,000-foot canyon. More deductions, all of them choice cuts. You don't forget Bob's tripping over a log and cartwheeling down the slope with a hindquarter strapped to his packboard. That bruised a lot of meat, some of which was elk. Further deductions. When you finally total the figures, you discover that Bob now owes you approximately 1/4 of an elk. Why, the charlatan hasn't even had the courtesy to mention the matter of this debt to you. And to think, you trusted him enough to let him help pack your elk out of a 3,000-foot canyon. Some gratitude. In the end, your calculations are for naught. Your spouse demands that you give Bob a generous share of the elk. You acquiesce reluctantly, but eventually conclude she was right, although this conclusion does not arrive until the middle of April, when even the thought of one more elk roast blights your day. "What's for supper?" you ask your wife. "Elk," she replies. "Ah!" you say. "How about TV dinners? I'm sick of elk." "You shot it, you eat it." "I know. I'll call Bob. He'd probably like some more elk." "Are you kidding?" Bob responds. "I'm fed up to my follicles with elk. I couldn't choke down another bite of elk if I lived to be 500. "Oh, yes, you can. And you are. You didn't take your full share. You packed it out and you're going to eat it." In this way, the problem of sharing a single big game animal between hunters usually resolves itself. My first encounter with the problem of sharing a big game animal occurred when I was 16. I was hunting with my cousin Buck, who was several years older than I. At that time, Buck was at the height of his intellectual powers and knew all there was to know about hunting and most of everything else. Some people are stingy with their knowledge and try to hoard it, but not Buck. He handed his out freely and voluminously and endlessly at all hours of the day or night, whether one was in the market for knowledge or not. Naturally, because of his towering intellect and absolute knowledge of all matters pertaining to hunting, Buck got to devise our field tactics. Shortly after dawn, as Buck was bathing my semi-consciousness with a steady stream of his hunting knowledge, I glanced up the side of the mountain to clear the glaze from my eyes and spotted 5 specks. The specks were moving. "Buck, there's a herd of mule deer up there," I shouted. Since a part of Buck's knowledge consisted of natural law that he was the only one who could spot deer first, he dismissed my report with a chuckle and the comment that the specks I saw were probably on my glasses. Then he stopped the car and got out, casually, as if to stretch and satisfy a need for a breath of fresh air. He got back in the car, shook a cigarette from a pack, lit it, and blew out the match. "There's a herd of mule deer about halfway up the mountain," he said. "When you're driving out to hunt mule deer, it's a good idea to stop every once in a while and check the slopes. Now you take these deer here. We might have missed them if I hadn't stopped for a look around." "Good, Buck, good. I'll try to remember that." Buck then laid out the tactics. "All right, now here's what we're going to do. You work your way up the mountain toward the deer. I'll drive around to the top and wait on the road just in case they try to cut back over the ridge. Why don't you climb the mountain and I drive around on the road?" "Because it wouldn't work, that's why. Besides, if the deer cut back over the ridge, we want to have the best shot to be waiting there." "Oh." I got out to start working my way up the mountain and Buck drove off, leisurely smoking a cigarette and fiddling with the radio dials. There was about a foot of new snow on the mountain, and the climb was cold, slippery, and exhausting. Occasionally, a fir tree would unload a bough of snow down the back of my neck, and that didn't improve my mood, either. Nor did the thought of Buck sitting in the warm car at the top of the mountain, drinking hot coffee from the thermos, and smoking and listening to the radio, while he gave the deer time to detect my presence, and then retreat practically into his lap. But it didn't work out that way. All at once, I found myself right in the middle of the herd of mule deer. A nice little buck stepped out from behind a tree and stared at me, as if astonished to find a human being stupid enough to be climbing a snow-covered mountain that early in the morning. I downed him with a single shot. The rest of the herd raced off in all directions except toward Buck. An hour later, I was back down at the road with my deer. Buck, who had witnessed the whole fiasco, as he called it, was waiting for me. He was hot, too. "Boy, that was dumb. Shooting that itty-bitty buck when there was one 3 times as big in the herd? I knew I shouldn't have given you the best chance, but since you're just a kid and all, I thought I'd do you a favor. Boy, did you blow it." We rode in silence all the way home, Buck occupied with what I could easily guess were dire thoughts, and I with gloating. When you're 16 and wear glasses and aren't that good at sports, and spend a good deal of time in the company of an intellectual giant, you don't get much opportunity for gloating. When you do, you savor it. "You just remember," Buck said, after dropping me and my deer off at home. "Part of that deer is mine." When I got around to cutting up the deer, I at first considered giving Buck a full half of it. On the other hand, I had my mother, grandmother, and sister to provide wild game for, and Buck lived by himself in an apartment. If he tried to eat half a deer all by himself, he would soon be sick of venison, and wouldn't want to go deer hunting ever again. No, I told myself it would be better if I gave him only a hindquarter. That would be about right for one person. On the other hand, steaks cut from the hindquarter of a deer are awfully good eating. Buck might use a venison steak dinner as bait to lure one of his girlfriends into his apartment. That, in all probability, could lead to Buck and the girl committing a serious sin. Since my religion forbade even contributing to serious sin, I was not about to risk going to hell over a hindquarter of venison. No, sir. Buck would have to make do with the front quarter. But which front quarter? That presented no real difficulty. Because of Buck's interest in science, he would be intrigued by studying the effects of a 30-30 slug on the shoulder of a deer. There was still a lot of good meat on the shoulder, too. Upon further consideration, I decided that Buck might prefer to forego his scientific studies and have the shoulder ground up into venison burger. So I ground up the venison for him. Well, that turned out to be an awful lot of venison burger for one person. I started dividing it up into neat piles until I found the exact amount that I thought would be suitable for Buck. I then left his share on the table while I went to deposit the rest of the venison in a cold storage locker. A few days later, I ran into Buck. "Hey, you little rat, where's my share of our deer?" I shook my head sadly. "You may have some trouble believing this, Buck, but while I was taking my share down to the locker, the cat got into the house and ate your share." Buck did not take the news well. Again, if you don't read McManus, you should. I'd argue that for anyone, but particularly if you do anything outdoors at all. He published 14 collections of his short stories. Those are the ones to get. He had another 6 mystery books later in his career that are, in my humble opinion, not as good. Do yourself a favor, though. Get a hold of one of his short story collections. These are very fine reading from a man who is an absolute master of his craft. And good luck dividing up your own moose, if you have a partner. It's a good thing that they're so stinking big, isn't it? For Field Notes, I'm Terry Fuller. Music from Loon Echo Lake provided courtesy of Solitudes at www.solitudes.com.